Hi everyone, welcome to the first recording. The topic for today is oxytocin use in labour increases the risk of postpartum hemorrhage due to uterine atony. This is a topic that I chose because I think it's something that is common but flies under the radar a little bit for those of us who practice in obstetrics. So the first point I wanted to make is that uterine atony is becoming more common in developed countries in the last two decades. There's a couple of papers I've referenced in the on the post on the webpage describing this process occurring in both Ireland and Canada, but it appears to be a common across most of the developed world. A few factors are contributing to this, and one of them is thought to be the increased use and prevalence of oxytocin in labour. So what is the mechanism that underlies this phenomenon? Basically, exposure to oxytocin during labour over time leads to downregulation and desensitisation of the oxytocin receptors on the myometrium. This leads to a decreased response to oxytocin when we use it or give it after delivery as a uterotonic. And so there is an increased risk of uterine atony. So the second point is that many women who have been in labour for a long time and whose uterus may be becoming tired or fatigued will often also be augmented with oxytocin, and this is probably an independent thing to the receptor phenomenon. So the oxytocin infusion could be considered a marker of women with tired or perhaps fatigued myometrium, and so this independently places them at higher risk of uterine atony. What should we be doing? So we need to try and recognize these patients before they deliver, and this is as simple as asking a few questions and making it a routine practice to ask these questions. And if we do identify this, we should anticipate that they're at increased risk of uterine atony and make some preparations and change the way we approach them, not just do the same thing that we would for someone who's having an elective caesarean, for example. So in theatre, the team, this includes the staff who check the patient in and the anaesthetist who's responsible for the pharmacological management of the third stage, should be asking the labour ward team who have been looking after the patient, how long has this woman been in labour? Have they been on oxytocin? If so, what duration and what dose have they been on? In our hospital, or our institution that I work at, we use 10 units and 500 mils in labour ward. And generally up to 60 mils an hour is a sort of standard dose, and a 60 to 100 mils an hour is considered high dose or a high infusion rate. So I'm using the example of the non-elective caesarean patient coming to theatre for failure to progress, but likewise there are many women down in labour ward who will have vaginal deliveries or instrumental deliveries who have also been on oxytocin infusions for a long time, and they are just as likely to be at risk of this phenomenon causing uterine atony. So what should we use in these women who have decided they are at high risk, and what should we use as the first line uterotonic? This is something that I wondered about, and I've had done a little bit of a literature search. I think at the present time the evidence is that we should still be using oxytocin as the first line uterotonic. So there's some human and rat studies indicating that even though the oxytocin becomes less effective in myometrium that's been exposed to oxytocin in labour, it still appears to be more effective than the other uterotonics, at least in vitro, and certainly it has less serious adverse effects. So my personal take on this is I will acknowledge that they are likely to be poor responders to oxytocin, but I'm going to give it at delivery as the first line uterotonic as we always have. I'm going to give the highest rate of the infusion right from the start. So in our institution, which uses 40 units and 500 mils, I'm going to start it straight away at 250 mils an hour. I'm going to give them a 2 to 3 unit intravenous bolus. And personally, this is my personal practice, if there's been no hemodynamic instability after 1 or 2 minutes, I will then repeat that bolus. And I'm quite happy to do that a few times. I think giving large boluses all at once are risky because of the hypotension and tachycardia you can cause, but certainly spacing out smaller boluses over a longer period of time I think is relatively safe. The next thing we're going to do is recognize that this may not work. So there is some evidence, and I've referenced a lot of the statements that I'm making in this podcast to articles that are listed, if you want to look them up yourself, on the post on the website. So there's pretty good evidence that the myometrium, although it's desensitized to oxytocin, it still responds in a normal manner to the ergot and prostaglandin F2 alpha uterotonic drugs. These drugs work via different receptors and different intracellular messaging systems, and the in vitro and in vivo evidence is that these responses are maintained at normal levels. So we should be expecting or considering the use of these drugs early. So after I've given the oxytocin, within 2 to 3 minutes I will be asking the obstetricians to give me an indication of whether they think they're working. What's the uterine tone? If it's poor, I will almost always proceed immediately to administering one of these other alternative drugs. Now, the important caveat to make at this point is that we need to be thinking carefully about the contraindications and the adverse effects of these drugs. So, most common one is ergometrin, and we're going to want to avoid this in hypertensive disorders or anyone with serious cardiac disease. And if we do give them, we need to anticipate that they are going to get nausea and vomiting. I'll often give a couple of antiemetics at the same time that I give the intramuscular dose of ergometrin. The other drug which we commonly use is carbaprost. The most serious adverse effects from them are bronchospasm and pulmonary vasoconstriction. So we probably shouldn't give it to someone who has got active asthma or is already wheezy. And be very careful if you're concerned about those things. These women may not respond to any pharmacological therapy, so it's important that you discuss with your obstetric colleagues, probably even prior to delivery, the early use of physical and surgical therapies, and you should probably institute some of these simultaneously with your escalating pharmacological treatment. By this I mean Bakri balloon tamponade, compression sutures like B-Lynch, and then even further down the list, escalating to uterine artery ligation, embolization if you're lucky enough to have that facility, or hysterectomy. Another point I'd like to make is that in these patients, if they are bleeding, consider the use of tranexamic acid early. This is obviously a contentious point, and I'm not going to go into detail discussing this, but my take is that recent studies such as the WOMAN trial and evidence from other surgical patient groups and large trials reassures me that I don't think there is a high risk of serious events like thrombosis with the use of tranexamic acid. And when someone's bleeding, I'll often, or it's developing uterine 18, I'll try and give it early. I think that's more likely to be effective if you give it early rather than late. Right. The final point I want to cover before I summarize everything is what about if we cease the oxytocin infusion? Will these receptors recover? So, you know, the commonest scenario probably is the woman who fails to progress. So they're exposed to a large amount of oxytocin during labor, and then unfortunately they don't seem to progress, and a decision is made that they're going to call it and bring them up to theater for a non-elective cesarean. Some recent evidence, mainly from a retrospective cohort study from Canada published last month, indicates that the short answer is yes, we should be stopping these oxytocin infusions as soon as we can. It does appear that the longer the uterus has to rest, then the more time it has to regenerate receptors, probably for the muscle to recover, and the less likely they are to bleed. So this is an important point to remember. Okay, so let's summarize the points that I've gone over. What are the main messages from this talk? First of all, we should try to use the minimum effective dose of oxytocin that we need in labor, and if possible, and it's not always, try to titrate the dose down when you can. Secondly, cease the oxytocin as soon as the decision is made to proceed to cesarean delivery. This will allow for time for the myometrium to rest and for the oxytocin receptors to regenerate. Thirdly, and this is probably the most important point, is we need to recognize these women. So we should be making it a routine practice to ask about this. Ask about the length of time they're in labor, oxytocin exposure. Following this, if we have recognized them, we need to anticipate that they're going to get, or that they are going to be at high risk of uterine atony, and get ready to give larger doses of oxytocin, add the alternative uterotonics early, and move to physical and surgical measures early. And a final point is that we can predict that these patients are going to develop uterine atony and hemorrhage, and so we should be thinking about involving experienced staff earlier rather than later. Often we can even get them involved before the delivery so that they're around at the time to help with the decision making and implementing some of these measures. Alright, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. Please leave some comments and feedback on the website if you have any. If anyone has any topics that they would like discussed, or any suggestions to make, they will be welcomed as well.